Welcome to Bits About Books, the home for conversations with authors of breakthrough books on sales, marketing, and business. Founders, entrepreneurs, and individual professionals, we all need to keep track of ideas that are helping create our today and tomorrow. Bits About Books will strive to find those books and speak to their authors, go behind the scenes and understand what inspired the authors to write the books that they did and how they went about doing so. Through our conversations, we hope to gain insights that will help us to get the most out of our efforts. I'm your host Shubhanjan Sarkar, founder of PitchLink, the next generation buyer-seller engagement platform where our mission is to make buying easy. Welcome to Bits About Books. Thank you for your time and for joining us in this session. I have a favor to ask. While you continue to listen to the podcast, please leave a comment or rating at iTunes or wherever else you get your podcasts from. I personally look at each comment and will give you a shout out to each of you in our following episodes. It means a lot to hear from you. Our guest today is Carol Mahoney, and we speak with her about her new just-to-be-published book, Buyer First, Grow Your Business with Collaborative Selling.
I realized that the way that we transform sales results is by transforming sales behaviors, which means transforming how we think about sales. The good news is that we can change our minds. And so the book, the chapter, Get Your Head in the Game, is really about how do we take a cognitive behavioral approach to sales performance? How do we become aware of our mindsets and how do we then change them? And it's not an overnight thing. It's not a magic pill. What's going to work for some person is going to work for another. But it does follow a basic framework of becoming aware of what the mindset is, where it comes from, what's the origin story of that mindset, and then what is the impact that it's having on the behaviors that I want for myself and the behaviors that I want to see from my buyers.
Author of Buyer First, Grow Your Business with Collaborative Selling, Carol is changing the way the entire sales industry sees itself and how buyers see it too. She has been called the sales therapist at Harvard Business School, where she coaches on sales for their entrepreneurial MBA program. She's also the president of the AAISP Boston chapter, been named as a top sales influencer by LinkedIn and Sales Hacker, and voted a top sales coach by Ambition. With the heart of a teacher and spirit of a coach, she's ready to share how you can unlock the success you have never thought possible. Now, onto this delightful and actionable session with Carol Mahoney. Carol, welcome to Bits About Books. I'm delighted to have you back. And what an important book this is. And I feel that it is such a rare book because very rarely would a consultant of your stature want vulnerability to be exposed. And mm-hmm. you have done it by choice. Mm-hmm. And that's remarkable.
Thank you. It's nerve-wracking too.
No, I really think that it places it somewhere else because the ability to connect becomes so much more pronounced, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
So tell me, after your previous book, what made you think that you're going to write another book and this is how it will be? Where did it all begin?
So this is actually my very first book. I have released like a small iteration of it before, maybe about 5 or 6 years ago, and ended up putting it up on my website just as a downloadable for people. Right. And, you know, I talk about our sales mindsets in that book. And it's a very, I guess you could say, academic sort of version of the book that I ended up actually writing, mm-hmm. Which was really kind of a culmination of some of the research. It was really the starting point for this book. This book came about, I mean, I've been trying to write it for probably 12 years. I did, you know, 10 years of research into the data behind what makes a successful salesperson based on 2.3 million sales professionals who've taken evaluations and assessments to understand predictably, you know, what are the beliefs, the mindsets, and the behaviors and skill sets that lead to success in sales. And combined that with the research behind behavioral change. How do we change our minds? How do we change our behaviors so that it sticks? So digging into the neuroscience, the psychology, the sociology, all of the behavioral sciences that I'm just kind of fascinated with the idea of why do we do the things that we do and why do we not do the things that we know that we should do, right? There's the, we know what to do, we know that we can do it, but somehow when we get in that moment to do the thing, we don't. We chicken out or we default to a previous behavior. And I was really kind of obsessed with that, both because of my personal experience in going through behavioral change, but then also the people I see around me and the clients that I worked with. And this book came about because this book is the book that I wish I had 20 some odd years ago when I first started my business. And in that realized I have to sell something. And how that impacted me, how that mindset impacted me and other mindsets that contribute to sales success. Because how we think becomes what we do becomes the results that we get. And so many sales books out there, all great tactics and strategies of the things that we should be doing, but it doesn't necessarily dig into the how do we do it and will we do it in the moments that we need to, because mindset is the beginning of everything. So I wrote this book for the person I was 20 years ago, but for the small business owner who in the pandemic decided to start their own business and are now in year two and year three of that, and maybe now wondering, should I just go get a job? Am I really cut out to do this? What are the hidden obstacles that are standing in my way? As well as the startup entrepreneur who's just launching their maybe tech business or professional services business or something, and they have to get their first customers. And also have conversations with VC and PE firms to get funding for their dreams. That all requires a sales conversation that they're not necessarily prepared to have or even know how to have, especially when you don't have a finished product to show off to people yet.
Right.
So, and then I also wrote it for salespeople because, you know, sales business has been turned upside down. And thank God for that, because it hasn't been working so well up to this point. But salespeople, even veteran salespeople, are trying to figure out this new normal of sales. How do we sell when buyers don't want to talk to us, don't want to respond to us? How do we do outreach and prospecting in a way that doesn't feel icky and slimy and pitchy? And how do I adjust to the new normal? How do I change my own long-held behaviors and mindsets about sales so that I can continue to align with how to sell with today's buyer, not at or to today's buyer?
Makes total sense. So walk me through this. So you had this downloadable, which you had written about 6 years back.
Yes.
And at some point, you decided it's time to actually expand that into the full book that was sitting in your head for some time.
Yeah. And but I didn't know. Yes.
And you said, okay, let me now actually structure it up and start writing it. So walk me through that process a bit.
So I was in a group program called Heroic Public Speaking, which is where I learned how to do keynote speaking and breakouts. And in the process of learning how to be a better performer on stage, I also learned that I had it, you know, the spotlight shows everything, the inner work that you need to do, the outer work that is the result of that. And during that workshop, I had some great personal growth and, you know, now enjoy being on a stage. But in that workshop, I met a woman named AJ Harper, and Jeanette Harper, and she has a group called the Top 3 Workshop. And essentially what she does and what she said in this workshop struck such a chord in me that it lit a bonfire that I had to do this book. And the thing that she said, because the thing that I had been struggling with for so long in writing this book was what to say, what to include, and, you know, what do I want people to think about this book? I was worried about what the book was about and instead of who it was for. And when AJ said, a book is not about you, I was like, I say this every day to all of my clients. It's not about me. The book isn't about me. It's about the reader who I'm trying to serve. The book isn't about something. It is for someone. And when I heard her say that, it was like, you know, those things that just echo in your mind and wake you up in the middle of the night. That's what was happening with me. Like, I was feeling guilty because I hadn't finished this book yet. And so going through the process of that was 2 years of writing that I did between the raw draft and, you know, sitting down and going through all of the messiness that I had to pour out into the book to, you know, now the final editing stages. But it was that kind of process of doing that helped me to actually write this book. The thing is, you know, being a business owner, an entrepreneur, and an author, it can be very isolating. And so finding those groups of people that can go on the journey with you, one, makes it less isolating. It also helps to expel what AJ calls the trolls in your head. I call it the BS. You know, I have these little poop emoji dolls that you might see hanging around somewhere, because we have these thoughts in our heads that get in the way of doing the things that we have the passion and desire to do. And so that's what made me decide that now is the time to write this book. In addition to like what I shared before, so many business owners are starting their businesses now, the majority of which are women. And also, you know, it's getting harder and harder to run and start a startup business, especially in this economy with VC funding hard to come by. So how do you put your best foot forward there? And then, you know, the average rate of success for salespeople is still around 50%. And so I made this my number one thing. Like every year I'm focusing on what's the number one thing I'm going to do. And this is it, is to put this book in the hands of every single person out there who needs it.
So what was your process? Well, you're right, because you are already doing your, you had a day job, so to say.
Yeah. Yes.
So what was your process? Like, did you choose a particular time? Or, I mean, I know authors who write only in the weekends. I know authors who write every day. So there are all kinds of people I meet. Everybody has a method, right? So what was your method?
So my method was in AJ Harper's Top 3 Group Workshop. Every day, Monday through Friday, there are two or three times in a day where everybody would get together on Zoom to sit down and write. AJ, one of my favorite sayings from her is that the first draft is just math. And so it was really like, you know, how do we put together an outline? How do we understand who this book is for? And so going through those steps before I even sat down to start to write, you know, organizing my content, making sure that my research was all in an accessible place so that I could find it without spending all of this time going and looking for it. And then using the outline as a draft. And then, you know, I blocked the time every day, 9 a.m., 10 a.m., and 4 p.m. At least two of those sessions, I made the commitment that I was going to go and to do that, as well as doing writing on the weekends or writing in the middle of the night when you wake up and an idea comes to you that you need to write down, or a story or a snippet. But having that dedicated time where I was accountable to other people, and also documenting the progress. So, you know, not only organizing everything and preparing it for when I was going to do the work, having an accountability group that was there to not only encourage me to, but to, you know, if you're going to lose weight and you want to go and exercise, the best way to do that is to find a buddy who you're going to go to the gym with, because you don't want to let other people down. Like, you know, you're going to show up there. You've made that commitment. But then also tracking it. So every week, tracking how many words did I write this week, breaking it down to how many words a day do I need to hit in order to reach these deadlines, was how I was actually able to get it done. Like you said, while being a consultant and a coach and a trainer and a keynote speaker and running a business, which is well more than a full-time job. So it's funny because during this process, everyone who I was, you know, family and friends all knew that I was writing this book. And, you know, I would listen to them tell their stories and we would have experiences. And at some point they would look at me and go, are you going to put this in the book? Which, of course, I did. So it's a process whereby it's having that group accountability, being prepared for it, being committed to dedicating and putting in the time. You know, there were days where I didn't feel like doing the writing. I didn't feel like sitting down. There were days where I would sit down and the blinking cursor on the screen was cursing at me. And I was looking at it and I'm like, I'm lucky if I get 5 words in today. And then there'd be other days where I'd get 5,000 words in or 14,000 words in. And so it wasn't like this, okay, we did 100, I think my count today was 750 words. And all right, today we got 10 in, you know, tomorrow we got 1500 in. And so it wasn't like this straight line, like any behavioral change, it went like this. But when you look at it over a longer period, just like in the stock market, if you watch the stock market every day, you'll go crazy because it's going to go like this. But if you look at it over a period of time, you start to see the progression and how it goes.
Right. Absolutely.
And this is how I'll write book 2, book 3, and book 4 after this. Like, I already have ideas that I started talking about for book 2 and book 3 and started drafting those outlines so that I know where in my schedule and time I'm going to be able to actually sit down and start writing these things. I've already started recruiting people for stories for the second book too. So it's just one of those things that once you've learned a process for something, that you can then adjust that process to your own personal style and tendencies so that you can get the work done. The other thing that I had to really do was Jeffrey Shaw has a book, The Self-Employed Life. And in his book, he talks about this technique called space switching, which is you actually create a space and environment for different types of work. Mm-hmm. So this is my home office. This is where I do my coaching calls, my training calls, my interviews. This is the space for that. My writing space, however, is upstairs in my living room on the couch facing the water, looking at the sunshine. Or my husband actually built me a little platform down at our beach with a little gazebo screened in shed. That became the What She Said Writing Shack. And I wrote the majority of my book down at the water at the beach. I also had a place in Florida with some family where I would go down there and do writing there. And so having separate places for different types of work helps your brain to kind of settle into that. The other thing that I did was absolutely made it a religious focus time, meaning that there were no dings of notifications that were happening. My phone was either not even with me or turned off somewhere and was a paperweight, like didn't have a million different browser windows open. And I actually would find ways to make myself focus better. So without the distractions, I was able to really gear into and get into the flow, as psychologists call it, of work. The other little trick that I learned for myself was I couldn't listen to music that had words to it, because while I'm trying to write words and I'm listening to words, it was, again, a distraction. And someone in the group had shared, you know, one of the things that they did was they listened to music soundtracks for video games, because they typically don't have words, and music actually neurologically impacts us. And so the beats and the motion and the even the tone and the music and the pitch and the all of that helps your brain to focus. Because if you think about it, video game music is designed to help people move through something and get things done in a video game. So it worked really, really, really well for me, and I still listen to it today. But now, you find all of these different things that you can start to build habits around so that you can get things done, like writing a book, starting a business, improving.
Fascinating. So where did you get those tracks, the video game music tracks?
I went to Spotify and searched video game soundtracks.
Really?
Yes.
I had no idea.
And then both of my 20-something sons are avid video game players.
Of course.
And so when they found out I was listening to video game music, they're like, oh, you got to listen to this track and this track. So I have a lot of Halo and Red Dead Redemption and, you know, a couple of other, like, you know, fighter types of games, because they're like, you know, they want you to get up and pumping and moving. Right. I've even turned some of them into, I like to go running through the woods. And so I've turned some of those video game songs into my running song tracks.
Interesting.
As well.
Before we actually move into the book, I want to touch upon your research. So what did you research for, and how did you go about doing the research?
So I started off the research just simply by going to academic libraries, doing very specific types of searches on Google, looking for academic research on particular things. And, you know, and then I reached a point where I was going to have to be a student at a university to really get access to the kind of databases of research that I was looking for. Mm-hmm. And so a colleague of mine from Women Sales Pros, Barbara Weaver Smith, it actually helped me with that research, because she's been a dean at a university. She knows how to, you know, structure research programs and things like that. And so her and I worked together, and she really challenged me on some of the hypotheses and assumptions that I was making. That really we looked back into the research to say, does the research actually support this, or is this, you know, something that doesn't support it? For example, I have a whole chapter about motivation and how do we motivate ourselves. And I had some theories that, you know, we can do motivation by setting goals in a certain way. And when she went and dug into the research, she's like, no, the research doesn't actually support that. In fact, it's quite the opposite. And for a second, I was like, well, crap, now what do I do? But that's when I realized that's what this whole process is about, is does the research actually support this, and what does it actually say? And then I started digging into, as I said, I have a database that I have access to through Objective Management Group of 2.3 million sales professionals. So I did a lot of sort of regressive analysis and statistical analysis on those data to see if it actually supported these hypotheses or things that I was observing, right? That is the scientific method, is you make an observation, you do some research to answer that question, you form tests around that, and then repeat and refine that based on the results that you get. So over the last 10 years, as I've been gathering this research, testing it out on myself, testing it out on my clients, who I lovingly call my sales lab rats, that's when I was able to start seeing, does the research back up what actually happens in the field, what actually happens with the people who are trying to implement this? I also dug into research from neuroscientists that are, you know, testing how people are reacting to certain types of content or questions being asked of them. So Harvard, Wharton, Stanford, all of these were the types of institutions that I was looking for this type of research. And, you know, and then talking with other experts in the field and saying, you know, am I thinking, am I on the right track? Because I'm not a scientist. I'm not even a psychologist. I am intensely curious, though. And so still then, you know, as you would in any academic setting, you come up with a thesis paper, you share it with your peers, and then they give you critical feedback on that. So I very much try to stick to that process as much as I could in the research. And when the research didn't support the hypothesis, then I made a test and to confirm that, and then adjusted my hypothesis accordingly. And it's led to a lot more experiments that I want to run for the next couple of books. But this was really the foundation of how do we change our behaviors? Because that is the one thing that we are all trying to figure out today, is how do we learn and adapt to our current circumstances before our current circumstances dictate it for us?
So can you mention one instance where you went into the hypothesis with something you believed was true, but it sort of threw back at you saying, no, this is not correct, and then you adjusted your hypothesis. Any example you can share?
So specifically on the motivation side of things, my hypothesis was that our motivation will increase if we set our goals in a way, like actually that I described before, where we think about our goals, we write those goals down, we share it with other people and create action plans, and then report to those people on a regular basis. My hypothesis was that by going through this process, that we can actually increase our motivation and continually fill our motivation in that way. And unfortunately, when I went back and looked at the research, there was one particular study that was done from Gail Matthews at the Dominican University. And that was the study that I had based this hypothesis on. And when I talked with others in my field, David Hoffeld, for example, who wrote The Science of Selling and has dug into this research in a similar way, he's like, you know, yes, that's what the study says, but there's been a lot of refute as to how valid that study is. So that's what first made me question it, which is when I worked with Barbara, I said, okay, let me see if how this plays out. As she was doing the research, I was testing this out with my clients. And what I found was, even having clients go through that process, like I just described those five steps, there were still those that it didn't make them feel any more motivated. It didn't increase their likelihood so much of seeing success. And so I knew that there was something missing. And so when I dug into that with Barbara, she had found some research. I'm forgetting the name of it, and I probably wouldn't be able to pronounce it correctly as well. But there's research that's been done by the Motivational Research Lab. And this particular scientist has spent the last 20 years studying human motivation and how to be more predictably motivated. And the one thing that he said is that there is not enough correlation and evidence for us to predictably say, this is how we get and stay motivated. There's too many variables that are at play. And that's what I was also finding with my clients. In some cases, they really were likely to see success. The data from Objective Management Group told me that people who have personally meaningful goals and are accountable to others for them and make regular reports and have an action plan are 298% more likely to be elite salespeople, which told me, okay, is this likely to happen? But the other research didn't necessarily back that up. And what I found was, is that how we motivate ourselves is going to be different based on where we are in life, variable number one. Variable number two being the kind of circumstances that we are in. You know, consider Maslow's hierarchy of needs. If you're trying to figure out how to pay your bills and not lose your house, it's going to be very difficult to be motivated to think about, you know, aspirational things. But then, you know, other factors such as how we were raised, our beliefs and our thoughts and our mindsets, how optimistic we are. There were so many different variables that I then started to have to dig into and research, which as a result made me a better motivational coach to my clients because I didn't just apply that one same framework to everyone. We started there and then we customized it according to where they were and their particular mindsets and beliefs.
Great.
It's time for a short break. Stay with us. After the break.
And, you know, that what they say is that we so often treat our buyers like Pavlov's dogs, right? That old study where he would ring the bell and we would train the dogs and they would come running. We somehow think by ringing certain bells for our buyers that they're going to just suddenly come running until we realize that our buyers are not dogs. They're cats. They're going to do what they want.
You are listening to a Business Podcast Network original. Podcasting is the fastest growing content marketing opportunity, which is untapped. We can help you craft your audio strategy and help leverage the wide reach and easy streaming capability that the smartphone penetration provides. It is easy, it is powerful and personal. Talk to us to find out how podcasting can help you build your brand and reach out to your targets like never before. Write to us at bpn@bizcast.in. That is bpn@bizcast.in. Business Podcast Network. Podcasts end to end.
Welcome back. I'm Shubhanjan Sarkar, your host for Bits About Books and founder of PitchLink, the buyer-seller engagement platform. Let's dive right back into the episode where we left it.
Let's get into the book. I'll skip the first two chapters. They're quite understandable. You are a salesperson and not about you. I think they pretty much say what they would be about. Let's jump to chapter three, where you talk about follow the new golden rule. And what is this new golden rule?
So the new golden rule is those who have the gold make the rules. The golden rule used to be do unto others as you would have done unto you, which kind of makes it all about you. But the reality is that in today's world, buyers are the ones with the power. They are the ones with the gold. They are the ones that make the rules. Unfortunately, most sales people, organizations, haven't really fully grasped that yet. They're still forcing people to go through their sales process. This is the way that we do it. Yeah, I don't care how far you are into your research. I'm still going to make you answer the same questions four times. And buyers are opting out, right? They don't want the product pitches. They want to know that you're actively listening to them and understand them and their world and their challenges and the implications of that. They want someone who's going to collaborate with them to come up with new ideas and help to think of things in a way that they hadn't thought of before. And they want people who understand their products and services in context of that. And unfortunately, most sales organizations and a lot of sales books focus on what you as a salesperson need, not on what your buyer needs. And then they wonder why it doesn't work, why it doesn't align. There's an exercise in the book that I ask people to go through, which is called the wee-wee factor. This is something that I actually learned from Jeffrey and Brian Eisenberg, who wrote a book called Waiting for Your Cat to Bark, which was one of my first business books that I read early in my career that really helped to shape my thinking about how to approach sales and marketing, and where the not about me started to form in my mind. And, you know, that what they say is that we so often treat our buyers like Pavlov's dogs, right? That old study where he would ring the bell and we would train the dogs and they would come running. We somehow think by ringing certain bells for our buyers that they're going to just suddenly come running until we realize that our buyers are not dogs. They're cats. They're going to do what they want. And so the wee-wee factor is just, this is one of the first exercises that I go through with my training and coaching clients. And it's amazing how they don't even realize this, but there's a reason why, which we'll get into later chapters, is how much do you talk about your stuff and you and what you want and your products, I, me, we, our, all of the we's. And how many times do you talk about your buyer, you, yours, theirs, which means because these are all buyer focused words. And if your we words are higher than your buyer focused words, you're wee-weeing all over yourself and buyers don't want anything to do with you. And so it's just sometimes simply being aware of and auditing our behaviors, what we say and how we say it, to understand, are we truly focused on the other person or are we just talking about ourselves? Which there's a reason behind that, which we get into in later chapters.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, I'm so tempted to actually digress and get into a complete different discussion, but which I'll not. I'll restrain myself and keep it for another day. let's move on to the next two chapters where you talk about get your head in the game. I can see the progression now, and find your people. So let's go and sort of talk about these two.
So the getting your head in the game is, this is the part of sales that not a lot of people are talking about, not enough people are talking about. And it's simply the concept, in the book we talk about the theory of reason induction and also the theory of planned behavior, which is a psychological theory that basically means how you think becomes what you do, becomes the results that you get. And so our attitudes towards behaviors like sales is a lot of times the thing that gets in our way of being able to learn the right behaviors and actually execute on those behaviors. You know, like if you don't like taking out the garbage, you're going to avoid taking out the garbage. Or if you do take out the garbage, you're going to do it as quickly as you possible, rush through it, you know, throw it in the bag, the raccoons get into it and you just ignore it. And then you have a whole bunch of trash all over your yard because you just hate dealing with the garbage. And so you avoid it. Or when you do it, you rush through it because you just, it's such an unpleasant task. And when you think about the fact that the majority of people out there, when they think of sales, if you read Daniel Pink's book, To Sell as Human, who is one of my endorsers of the book, I'm so excited. What he says is that, you know, 7 out of 10 people, when they think of the word sales, they think of pushy, slimy, sleazy, used car salesman, still to this day. And so if you think about combining the theory of reason induction and planned behavior, how our attitudes indicate our behaviors and results, and that the majority of us have somewhat of a negative mindset towards sales, then it's almost as if we're becoming and creating more of the same thing because of our mindsets. Because how we think about things is how we do things. And when I realized this, that I realized that the way that we transform sales results is by transforming sales behaviors, which means transforming how we think about sales. And, you know, I can't even tell you how many clients come to me and say, I want to get more customers and clients in, but I don't want to be salesy. I don't want to be the pushy, slimy salesperson. And anytime you ask me to pick up the phone and call somebody, that's what I'm going to think of. And so to get past that, there's a lot of behavioral change that needs to happen. The good news is that we can change our minds. And so the book, the chapter Getting Your Head in the Game is really about how do we take a cognitive behavioral approach to sales performance? How do we become aware of our mindsets and how do we then change them? And it's not an overnight thing. It's not a magic pill. What's going to work for some person is going to work for another. But it does follow a basic framework of becoming aware of what the mindset is, where it comes from, what's the origin story of that mindset, and then what is the impact that it's having on the behaviors that I want for myself and the behaviors that I want to see from my buyers. Because one of the things that people don't realize is that mindsets are contagious, either because we're projecting our mindset onto someone else's behavior or because we're setting the example of something and they're adopting it themselves. The reason this chapter is so important, both as a salesperson, a business owner, and an entrepreneur, is not just because it's going to change your sales results. It's also important because when you grow your business or you become a sales manager and you have to hire salespeople, those mindsets that you have are contagious to the people that you work with. In the analysis that I did of Objective Management Group's data, what I learned was that when sales managers, I took like a subset, I think it was 500 sales managers and the teams that directly reported to them and looked at how do their mindsets and behaviors impact their team and at what rate. And what I found was that sales managers who had non-supportive beliefs in sales, which is the thing that is the foundation for all of our sales mindsets, from controlling our emotions to our need for approval to discussing money to overcoming rejection to, you know, dealing with stalls, put-offs, and negotiations. What I found was that managers with negative beliefs around sales had a 355% more likely chance of their salespeople holding those very same beliefs. And the teams who had really positive beliefs, it was because their manager did. So a manager with positive beliefs was 1,000% more likely to pass it on to their teams. And guess what? Their teams performed better. And so the thing I took away from this is, one, we can change our beliefs, we can change our mindsets, and the positive ones have a bigger impact than the negative ones. But it's a lot of work to develop those and maintain them. That's why it doesn't happen very often.
Yeah, and I also think that this whole, the ecosystem that where we salespeople exist, it is so conflicting and contradictory in terms of the messages that we get, because I mean, there are experts who are really experts or who are posing as experts, whatever. I mean, I don't want to get into that. But basically, so much of messaging is happening, which is contradictory. And we also sort of expect behaviors from the buyer, which we are not going to be, which we ourselves will not actually execute on.
Yeah.
I actually ran a poll. Carlos, sorry, I just want to tell you, I ran a poll and I asked salespeople, how many of you pick up cold calls? I have nothing against cold calls. But,
right.
But the fact is, it's not very effective. I mean, it'll work in certain cases, but trying to say that in 15 seconds and the first five words, I'll put a hook so that you will, I mean, it's like expecting too much and also undervaluing the buyer, thinking that, oh, you know, he or she can get hooked by this very smart thing that I'm going to say.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I interrupted you.
No, but you're absolutely correct. The thing of it, like, you know, talking about cold calling, for example, is that it can work in some situations, depending on the preparation and your buyer and your approach and how you do it. I'm actually working with a coaching client now who's doing exactly that. So there is a way to do it. But a lot of it, traditional techniques, you know, you say what you will, but a lot of it's based on luck. Like you just happen to hit the right person at the right time when they maybe were thinking about this or struggling with this. So the trick is for cold calling and outbound outreach to be effective is that you have to get lucky on purpose. And which means making 100 dials a day might not make you lucky on purpose, but making, let's say, 50 very targeted, personalized outreaches to people and not just doing it once, but over a period of time is a much more effective way of doing that than it is just slamming through 100 calls or cold emails that we all get every day and automating it even worse.
Yeah.
And we're just turning, we're training our buyers to ignore us when we do that.
Yeah, absolutely. As I said, I mean, this can take us to a completely different tangent. I'll not do that. I'll stick to the book. So when you talk about find your people,
yes,
is it about sort of building your own tribe or is it something else?
Well, so it's to dispel the myth that in order for you to get customers, you have to talk to complete strangers. It also dispels the myth that even if you don't know directly people who are your buyers, that other people either won't be willing to introduce you or refer you, or that they don't know other people like that. And so when I talk about find your people, it's really more about looking at who are the people that you already know in your network who are representative of your buyer or know someone who is representative of your buyer that you can start to have collaborative conversations with to understand their world so that when you do outreach to strangers later on, you have a very clear personalized idea of what's happening in their world, how they think about it, the challenges they have, what they've tried, what's worked, what hasn't worked, why they think that is, why this is even important for them to fix to begin with at all, and really collaborating with them in a way to design products and services that meet their need. Like me, when I was first struggling to write my book and it was all about what I wanted to say and what I wanted to do and what I think everybody needed, instead of making it all about the reader and knowing everything about what was going on in their head and in their world. It's the same concept. And even if you're a salesperson in a company going into a new role, you can do your outreach, your cold prospecting in a way that isn't pitchy or slimy or sleazy. And instead, it's a human connection, one human with another, just as if you were to walk up to someone in a room where you were a complete stranger in a networking event and you would start up a conversation. It's still just being a human being. And so the find your people chapter is first with, you know, whenever we go through any kind of a behavioral change, it's very scary. It's risky, any changes. And so to make it easier for people to start, I have them start with the people that they know. It's a lower risk situation where they can start to practice some of these behaviors so that they can start to shift their mindsets. You know, like if you were to tell me tomorrow that I need to go and run the Boston Marathon and I'm just struggling to get to running a 5K, I'm going to freak out. And so I didn't want my readers to freak out. I wanted them to start with something small. Run a 5K first before you start running the Boston Marathon. And so this is just a way to ease them into and get them to start practicing, getting the reps in and having these kinds of conversations before they have to get in front of the people who are going to be the strangers, that they're going to have to be able to show that I know you, I understand your world. I've talked with a lot of people just like you who are facing the same things. Here's what I've heard them say. Did you know that? XYZ. Add some kind of an insight to that. So that's what the Find Your People chapter is about, as well as what kind of research do you need to do to understand their world before you start getting in touch with them? But where do you, what are the places to look for? What's the kinds of things to look for to help you have a personal understanding kind of a conversation with people? As well as that serving you as a footprint later on for creating lists of people that you want to reach out to or that you want to know or you want to get introduced to. So it's starting with something small and non-threatening to get the practice reps in to prepare them for later on, I am going to ask you to actually call on strangers. Little steps, baby steps.
Absolutely. Makes so much sense because I think we are always thinking in terms of buyers. So the go-to question is, do I know somebody who will buy from me? And I think that's the wrong question. The question is, can I talk to someone who can tell me what my buyer is thinking?
Exactly.
And then that makes it easy to talk to strangers, right? So absolutely. Right. I think this is such an important thing. And fantastic.
Yeah.
So let's jump to the section on collaborative selling, where you talk about sell with your buyers.
Yeah. I was getting advice from some people that I needed to come up with some term for my methodology. And I've always shied away from that because we get the ABCs, the alphabet soup of sales methodologies and processes. And, you know, it was very glitchy and everything. And I really resisted it. So there's no special acronym. That's intentional. Because what I found through the research, and this is another example of how the research actually guided my hypothesis in this. I had been working with coaching clients and salespeople and trainers and small business owners for well over 10 years. And I had developed this process with them that we called layered questions. I now call it buyer first phase questions. But the idea being is that, you know, we tend to not go deep enough in our question asking. And so what are the kinds of questions that we need to be asking to truly understand our buyers? And as it started having a really profound impact with my clients, that I kind of wondered, all right, why is this working as well as it's working? And so I started digging into some of the research and found a lot of different studies, but it started with one from LinkedIn. And there was a LinkedIn State of Sales report, I think it was in 2020. And then they had a buyer first report in that they asked the buyers, what is it that you value most in salespeople? And the number one thing and the number two thing was that they valued salespeople who actively listened to them and came up with solutions and ideas that they hadn't considered or thought of before. And when they also then asked salespeople and sales managers, what's the number one thing that you look for in your sellers? Sales managers listed active listening as the last thing. So there's definitely a disconnect happening there. Yeah. And I started to think about, you know, the active listening piece and the collaborative piece. Then I read Deb Calvert's book with her co-authors, Stop Selling and Start Leading. And they had surveyed and interviewed, I think, just over 500 B2B buyers. And what are the things that those are, what types of experiences did those buyers value most? And they valued people who collaborated with them, who actively listened to them. And that made me even more curious. And so then I started digging into some research from Stanford and Harvard. And I came across to Harvard had a study that they did in 2012 called the IKEA effect. IKEA is that furniture store where you can, you know, order your stuff and you put it together yourself. They called it that because the question in the study that they were seeking to answer is, would people be willing to pay more for something that they put together themselves or something that was put together for them by an expert? And what they found was that when people felt that they had co-created something with someone else, the IKEA effect, I put it together myself, they gave me the instructions and the know-how, they put more value in that and were willing to pay more for that than something that was put together for them by an expert. And isn't that what we do as business owners and as, you know, entrepreneurs, is that we lock ourselves away into the ivory tower and we design everything that we think that people are going to need, just like I was thinking about my book in the beginning. And then when we bestow it upon our subjects, they're not interested and we can't understand why. And so I also then found, how do we collaborate with people? Like, how do we do that in an effective way in sales? And that's when I found two studies, one, another one from Harvard and another one from Stanford University. The study from Harvard, I actually discovered by reading Robin Dreeke's book, The Code of Trust. He is an FBI behavioral analyst, really digging into the human psychology. And what he found is that in this study is that when people are, when people talk about themselves, the things that they think, the things that they want, their opinions on something, that it lights up the part of our brain that releases dopamine, which is the pleasure center of our brain. It makes us feel good to talk about ourselves. That's why it's so easy to have the wee-wee factor in sales, to talk all about what we know and what we want, because of the dopamine that it releases in our brains. And it is also the part of our brains where we form human emotional attachments, where we build relationships. And so what I thought of was, if we are getting our buyers to talk more about themselves and what they think and what they want, that's how we can build trust and rapport with them. Then I found a Stanford study that showed that when we ask open-ended sequential types of questions, that as the person asking the question, it helps us to understand the other person better. And the person being asked the question, it helps them to change their minds, even if they believed something different before, simply by asking those open-ended, thought-provoking kinds of questions. And so when I saw all of this, I thought, if we could just collaborate with our buyers in our sales process, both in how we're understanding their world and their challenges in our discovery process, and what is their buying process throughout all of this, and then tie that to our sales process instead of starting with our sales process and imposing that on them and all of our features and benefits, if we do this in the reverse, then we're going to have more better relationships with our buyers. We're going to create better buying experiences, which is going to lead to better sales results. Oh, and by the way, it also leads to better customer retention later on, because it still costs more to get a new customer than it does to keep one. And so that's what the selling with your buyer is all about. That selling is not something we do to them or at them. Selling is something we do with our buyers if we hope to be effective with them, if we hope to help them solve problems. Because sales is all about connecting problems and solutions together, right? That's what makes the world a better place. We are selling change. That's what sales is all about. And if we can't manage change within ourselves and help our buyers to do the same, we're going to keep coming up with the same kinds of results as before.
I totally agree. In fact, I mean, this is so profound and on the dot. One of the things that I always think about, and again, maybe slightly off the topic, but I think the entire set of terminology that we use today, mm-hmm. they're so we, right?
Yes.
So all the terminologies that we use in sales, including discovery, mm-hmm. no client wants to be discovered, right? They want to be listened to. They don't want to be mm-hmm. discovered. The problem is that our whole set of terminology that we're using, and a lot of them are actually from war, right? So as if I'm going into a war with my buyer, I have a battle to win. Mm-hmm. So we have a big problem there, and I think a lot of what you are talking of and what we need to sort of shed, the mindset bit, the vocabulary, the thinking, all is actually coming from those derivatives of extremely age old set of words that we use today, still use today, which are completely contextually irrelevant, but we believe that that's what our process is about.
It's like you just peeked inside my head for book two. Because it is about the language that we use, it is about the environments that we create in our sales organizations. This is why you will often hear me say that a lot of companies and sales orgs are creating the very problems they're trying to solve for. Stalled deals, missed forecast, burned out salespeople, not hiring the right salespeople. It is really just a result of our own creating because of the language that we use. I often will say to my coaching clients, you don't discover things, you uncover things. You don't qualify, you align. Like, and so just, you know, that'll be what book two is going to be all about, is how do we create the environments for behavioral change, both from the words that we say to the actions that we take and the examples that we set. You know, so often in sales leadership and sales management, we're just, you know, the stuff rolls downhill, as they say here in the US. And that is so very true, because the environments that get created typically come from pressure that's coming from the top as a reaction to something that they see happening or about to happen. And because of a lack of communication, transparency, and culture, it ends up being this toxic type of a workplace, you know, that now becomes viral videos on YouTube when you tell your people to just suck it up because they're not going to get a bonus while you just made a $4 million bonus.
Exactly.
I digress. Exactly. Another road we could go down another later date.
Absolutely. And we should at some point, because and I do believe that they had some value. I mean, 20 years back, they had some value. Today, no more. I think we have to accept that.
That was the reason why it was so important for me to write a book that's going to get in the hands of the people who are on the conversations every day with their buyers. Because if we wait for leadership to figure it out with all of the stressors and everything else, and then middle management and all of the chaos that's happening there, you know, it's like the trickle-down economic theory that doesn't really work. Yeah. And so I wanted to get this in the hands of the people who need it the most, the people who are having those conversations every day, that everything is riding on them. Sales is the lifeblood of any business.
Absolutely.
Yet it's treated as this, you know, dirty word for the most part. And you know, who are the first people to get cut in a layoff? Salespeople. What's the one thing that you need to get through it? Salespeople. Anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. And the crux is because when the times are okay, you let systemic inefficiency build, which is what you believe you are cutting off, and it happens to all the places where you don't define. So whether it's marketing spend, you cut off. To my mind, if you're not marketing, not building your brand, not communicating with your larger universe, I mean, we all know that at any point of time, 3% of the market is trying to buy. What happens to the balance 97%? We don't care.
Yeah, you're just digging yourself a bigger hole.
Exactly.
you're digging yourself a bigger hole that you can bury everybody in.
Yes.
Bits About Books is brought to you by PitchLink, the buyer-seller engagement platform. PitchLink makes buying easy by enabling high-quality engagement between buyers and sellers through its presentation and discussion modules. Sellers create customized sales narratives using sales collaterals and personal videos, and reach out to prospects through a non-intrusive, buyer-qualified engagement. PitchLink requires no installation or download and holds the entire repository of sales collaterals and buyer-seller conversations. Talk to us to know more about how you can engage with customers without intrusion. Call us on 99021-631-32.
So tell me, this book is going to get released in September, but it has started. Yeah, you have started the early bookings. So tell a bit about how people can lay their hands on the book and when that they will get it, so that we can put the word out.
So if you go to carolmahoney.com, so C-A-R-O-L, don't forget the E, mahoney.com, you'll see a link there under books, which will then take you to the Buyer First book where you can pre-order the book. Now, because I'm so eager to get this into the hands of people as soon as possible, I'm giving away a lot of stuff between now and September to give them this information, to give them these strategies and tactics, as well as mindsets. And so what we're doing is that, you know, pre-order started yesterday and it's going to run through September 5th. And when you pre-order, we have a series of every month, we're going to be giving away extra content and events. So on May the 4th, we're going to be doing our first ever Buyer First workshop, where we're going to actually be, you know, interacting with people, helping them to form buyer first types of questions, you know, evaluating what their we factors are, you know, getting an understanding of their buyers and even their sales origin story. Where do they think about sales, and workshopping that out to try and give them some early tools and tactics to start to see some quick wins with. Then we're going to have another promotional thing that's going to be happening, where if you pre-order the book before May 20th, then you get included in a group coaching call. So the landing page for the book has a list of all of the different bonus content that we're giving away. Two other things, though, is that the earlier you sign up and so earlier you give us like your receipt of the pre-order book, you get access to all of that content. So if you, you know, pre-order now, you get all five pieces of bonus content. You know, you, the later you get, the, you know, the smaller the bonus content package you get. And so I'm trying to really help people to get this in their hands as soon as possible, especially teams. Like if you have a team of, say, you know, 25 or 50 people and you want to give this book to them and do a quick workshop, you know, we're offering that as well as at a much reduced rate. And the other thing is this, you know, the theme in the book is it's not about me. And I was thinking hard about, like, you know, what is a charity that I can support that reflects that? And, you know, these t-shirts that I've designed years ago for my clients, all of the proceeds for these t-shirts go to the Sales Education Foundation Barbara Guillamanco Scholarship Fund, which is to help more women enter sales programs at the college level. And I thought, what a great charity to donate 10% of the net proceeds of the book to. You know, $1,000 scholarship per student. I would love to be able to fund the whole program next year and, you know, give away tens of thousands of dollars in scholarships because the book has been so successful. So, you know, we're really relying on our networks and the people who believe in this message and the forward direction of sales today to also support getting more women in sales. Lori Richardson, who's both a friend and mentor and colleague of mine, who runs a lot of women in sales programs. She's president of the Women Sales Pros organization. And so she's one of the best connectors in women in sales that I know. And her and I were talking the other day about this, you know, pre-order campaign. And I said, you know what, Lori, your mission is to get more women in sales because of the opportunities that it gives. And I'm all about changing the perception of sales. I believe that the more women we get in sales, the more we'll change the perception. And the more we change the perception, the more women we're going to get in sales. So even though we have different missions, they align so well together. I was just so excited to be able to give this kind of an opportunity to other women to enter and learn into sales. And at the same time, help other business owners and entrepreneurs grow their businesses, feed their families, create more jobs, especially in like industries like climate change and technology. Like these are things that can really change the world. So yeah. I'm excited for the pre-orders. It's like the next 4 months, like this is my all consuming thing.
All the best. And I'm sure all your targets will be met. Carol, thank you for your time and for talking to us about your book. I'm excited about it. And I think it'll make a lot of difference to a lot of people who are still trying to wrap their head around what's the best way to go about this.
Yes. Thank you so much, Sanvajan. I'm so excited to share this. I want it to just be throughout the world. And, you know, ultimately, Christmas morning for me is when someone emails me or messages me on social media and says, this had a huge impact on me. I was able to do these things. My favorite emails from clients is when I work with them and a year later or years later, they email me and say, I'm doing this now. And I never would have ever thought that that was possible before. That's Christmas morning for me every day.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
We have a fantastic lineup over the next couple of episodes with great conversations on breakthrough books. Subscribe in your favorite podcast app so you do not miss a single episode. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for being with us today on Bits About Books, where we talk to authors about breakthrough books on sales, marketing, and business. We hope this conversation helped inform and motivate as we all navigate a rapidly changing business environment. For us, these are enlightening conversations enriched with knowledge and expertise. We encourage you to go out and buy the book to learn firsthand and implement some of the great ideas we discussed today. We hope to have you with us again in the next exciting episode of Bits About Books. If you liked what you heard, subscribe to the show in your favorite podcast platforms like iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts from, and give us a rating while you are at it.
This BizCast original podcast is produced for PitchLink, the next generation buyer-seller engagement platform, where the mission is to make buying easy. Hosted by Subhanjan Sarkar and produced by Rajiv Aditya. See you next time and have a wonderful day.